Hey folks, you're listening to Blammo. It's me, your host, Jeremy Kirkland. How you doing this week? Right before I was recording this, I burnt my finger, man. I'm not even kidding. I was making a quesadilla. It was a turkey quesadilla because I was using deli meat because I'm, you know, this broke guy who all of a sudden is cooking deli meat quesadillas on my stove. And I burnt the back of my fingertip, right? Like under my fingernail. It's stupid. Whatever. That's what I'm doing. Anyone else dealing with that? I'm dealing with that in allergies. Look at me. I'm 95 years old hosting a podcast. Is this what I do now? Am I getting weak? I don't know. I don't understand my body. I'm going to the gym. I'm doing the things. I'm lifting the weights. But man, allergies, finger burns. Maybe it's because I'm eating like a child. Who knows? That being said, I'm starting to pack for Tokyo. Yep. I'll be out there soon. Thanks for all your hot tips. Some of your tips were pretty good. Pretty good. I'm recording some pods out there, making some videos, and I'm generally just going to be some level of a clown that I am here. But I'll be cruising the streets of Tokyo. Can't wait. Listening to my tunes. I got my tunes all set up. A couple movies for the plane. Going to try to get some new fits off. It's just going to be great. Speaking of tunes, one of my favorite bands, actually, local natives, are on the show this week. Taylor Rice, Ryan Hahn. If you're not familiar, Local Natives they're an incredible band. They were basically a band that blew everyone's mind when they first came on the scene, and they've really continued to create some of the most beautiful music out there. But before we dive in, one of the things that I love to explore with musicians and just people really in general, guests on the show, it's not just their style, right? Or music in this case, but it's hearing how your work as an artist evolves as you get older, right? I often find bands' fourth or fifth albums, or even designers, whatever, their later collections far more interesting because now you're in it, right? Like now it's your job to do. Most of these people, you started off, it was a passion, and you lucked out or you crushed it, and then it became a career. But now your career is this. And I think it's really interesting to explore what it looks like to make art for work, like to make art to live. And I'm not discounting Local Natives at all. I'm not discounting Local Natives at all. But I think that's a very interesting thing to explore. But we talk about it. because, you know, I mean, with Taylor and Ryan, their parents, they're married, they're figuring out the balance in their life, and it shows in their music. And I, for one, that is the thing that I'm the most fascinated with and the most interested in. And honestly, I mean, I think I just love to discuss it with everyone, and we get into it. So that being said, we're going to jump right in. We chat getting into Steely Dan, LCD Sound System Will Never Break Up, they tricked everyone, albums as a format, life on the road, grief, good Lord, Oasis, 90s music, and their new album, But I'll Wait For You. Local Natives on the pod. Let's go. I did just finish my final listen through of your record.
Cool.
Not that like I'm never going to listen to it again, but like usually when I listen to a record, you know, I got a backpedal here.
First and final listen.
That's it. That's all you get. No, I
that's
mean,
fair.
Cause this is kind of like your Amnesiac. No,
I'll take that. I mean,
we haven't referred to it that way internally at all, but totally know what you're talking about.
Equally good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. I think, especially right now, and this is, you know, I don't know if you guys feel this. I think we're probably close to the same age. Like I'm almost 40, and, I don't want to listen to music that doesn't feel like it's challenging me. You know, like I'm very much into music now that I feel like the writing and the production and stuff feels a little bit more real and less kind of like cookie cutter. And like, I genuinely mean this where like, I am, you know, like I was just saying, like, you know, I'm dealing with marriage and kids. I got two kids now. I'm dealing with aging family members. I'm dealing with crisis of identity. I'm dealing with, you know, the desire to support family, but like also having some of my friends who are stuck being the age they were when we met, and all these like things are like hitting me like tidal waves all the time. And I feel like I have to process this through music. And when I'm listening to a song, and look,
I love the Beatles, but when he's just saying "Let It Be" over and over again, it's not fucking working, you know. So I need
it's not cutting it.
I need some depth. I need some emotion here. So,
oh man, yeah. Yeah, I mean, God, I can't tell you. I feel like we're right there with you. I feel like we've been feeling a lot of those same things. And that's what kind of like, you know, making these two records felt like, all of us kind of simultaneously going through these things, being apart, but then coming back together. And even just like what you're saying about listening to music that challenges you. Like my wife and I just had our first kid 6 months ago, and you can see my record player over here. I used to sit and listen to records and look down on people that didn't sit and just enjoy music. Like, and I'm like, when do I have time to do that anymore? Yeah. Like,
we're not going to enjoy the AI takeover.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
No, yeah. I'm not.
That's not going to be for you.
Yeah. And it's funny because I get to talk to a lot of other musicians stuff on this pod. And like, this is my little lifesaver, this little USB DAC that I use.
So I can. Jewel for a second.
Yeah, you would think, right? No, because I'll sit and I'll listen to records, you know, in different, when I was saying earlier, like I'll do like kind of like three different stages. I'll usually do the car. Mm-hmm. Then I'll do like on a walk, you know, like listening to an environment, and then I'll just sit and listen to it all the way through on any sort of like lossless thing I can. So if I can do like, you know, 24 bit or whatever, just like to experience, you know, the record the way it was, like, I think
for sure.
It's probably happened during the pandemic. Like I was talking with Ezra Koenig, and we were like talking about like getting really, really into Dylan and just like put on the record and sit. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You don't have your phone. You're not researching where the mic was. You're not, you know, you're just sitting and you experience the music, and it's a game changer.
You're not two screening it. You're not watching Netflix and scrolling, and you're fully in it. I mean, that was me over the pandemic with, and this happens to probably a lot of men our age, but I got into Steely Dan, and that's all I was doing. Just sitting and like enjoying it, and like, pure presence, just loving it.
Which album did you get into the most?
I started just from the beginning, and just at each album. My favorite right now is probably Royal Scam, because I feel like it's a nice like in between when it got too clean and it was still kind of like had a little bit of like rock elements. But I literally just my uncle was getting rid of his collection and just gave me all their records. So I just like went front to back, like, and just fell in love with each record. Just, I think like anything, like, I'd heard about Steely Dan like my whole life, and it just never appealed to me. And then something just clicked, and I was like, oh, this is what I need.
Yeah. It's like age and back pain. And all of a sudden you're like, exactly. I do like Steely Dan.
Yeah.
You're like, damn it.
I looked in the mirror. I was like, it's happening. It's happening to me.
Yeah, totally. And then Ryan was bringing that influence into the writing room a little bit. What's going on with some of these ideas? But he's winning the rest of us over slowly.
Slowly.
I will say,
against our will.
Yeah, yes. I mean, Pretzel Logic feels like, mm-hmm. I mean, I did a Berklee program for a bit, and I feel like everyone that I met there was all into Pretzel Logic, and that's like the default, you know, your jazz theory fusion crap that you start to mix in. Because I was very anti-Steely Dan for a long time, mainly because my dad was a musician. I grew up in a studio and all this stuff. And so like, he was like, no, this is really good music. And I was like, Dad, no, Creed, man. And he was like, you idiot. Oh, he's like, no, you need to listen to Steely Dan. We're going to listen on these NS10s. You can do the tannoys over here. You know, it was very much like
you
have to
say Dylan or Beatles or something, but you just came in hot with, Creed to your dad. Oh,
well,
man.
I feel like so neither of my parents were like musos like that. That's amazing that your dad was like that. I remember sitting my dad down when the first Mars Volta album came out, and it was like, Dad, you like Led Zeppelin. Like, this is the new Led Zeppelin. Like, so like earnestly telling him, like, this is the new Led Zeppelin.
Well, how do you take it?
I think he was very confused and probably sad for like my generation. I think it was just like, he's like, what is this?
Those stories remind me, I feel like we have to touch on, like, Ryan and I, we met when we were 12 and picked up guitar then. And our very first band, we grew up in like Southern California in Orange County in the hardcore scene.
Like Kodo? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
That shocked me that you said that. Oh my God.
Oh my God. That is where Ryan lived in Kodo. And that's where the garage was.
The garage.
Where our high school band started.
Hell yeah.
But actually, before the Kodo days, even like in junior high, it was hardcore. And our first show was in a cul-de-sac in the daytime, just surrounded by like kids and parents with like the, you know,
campers. Yeah.
And I was rolling on the ground screaming. And you can like only imagine
how like cringy
what our parents were thinking, you know?
Yeah.
I bet they fucking loved it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's true.
You have a kid now.
Doing that, I would be down.
Yeah. If my kid fucking did that, I would lose my shit. My daughter just started to get into the Beatles, and I'm explaining to her like conflict and people getting upset and people leaving the band and stuff, and she's locked in. So I think it's cool that you did that. I mean, I was trying to do bands when I was younger, but yeah, I mean, I was into like Incubus and Creed and Limp Bizkit, but I had to hide a lot of that stuff because my dad was a pastor, and so I had to kind of like sneak, you know, certain things. I would like find other stickers to cover the parental advisory, and then they got smart. And they printed it on the disc booklet.
Couldn't even remove it. Man, that was such a thing. I remember like a friend of mine, his mom would be like, you can only listen to tracks like 3, 7, and 9. You know,
that's
like
going
through it. Like, oh, so amazing.
I love your dad being like, but the purity of Steely Dan's jazz theory is a direct relationship to the Lord.
Well, right. And it's funny because the other band he really, really loved, absolutely loved their production. Everything about him was Tool.
Ooh.
So he was into like Manor James Keene and all this stuff. And I was like, Dad, I was like, this guy is not, you know, I don't think he's like, you know, a Christian or anything. And my dad was like, who cares? He's making
great art.
Yeah, it's spiritual in the musical level. That's incredible. I love that.
Yeah, wow, your dad was like forward thinking for that kind of like 90s Christian. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I feel like Tool is one of the bands that if their videos came on MTV, I would get a little like scared.
Right.
I mean,
claymation people dying and wilting and all this.
I loved their music, something about it, but something about it also scared me as like a young Christian boy.
Okay. Like, did you grow up in the church too?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like probably the first thing I ever did was play like, you know, third guitar in a worship band, like at our mega church that Taylor and I grew up in.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. That was me too. I was, you know, playing Third Day and Chris Tomlin.
Wow.
And,
where did you grow up, Jeremy?
In St. Louis, Missouri, which is coincidentally where I live now.
Oh, cool.
You know, my thing is, you know, I grew up heavily in the church, played music a ton, and wanted to be a rock star, and then moved to left high school, graduated high school in like 2004, and then moved that year to New York. But I had to work at a church in order to move to New York. The church imploded and kind of was, you know, just self-imploded by overly church people in the church. And then I was like, well, fuck it. I'm going to keep trying to make music, and then played music for a long time, was in a bunch of different bands, and then befriended Ezra and the Dudes Vampire Weekend, and then Paul Banks from Interpol. And then they got me a job at Beggars.
Oh,
and
amazing.
I worked at Beggars for a long time. And then, but you know, I kind of had to like, I mean, now I just play, you know, Jim Croce songs with my kids, but like, I was so like, I was touring, I was like locked in, I was doing all this stuff. And then I was like busting my ass, and I met my wife, and I was like, I'm making decent money working at the label, or I can make, you know, an eighth of that on the road playing, you know, wherever, and, you know, trying to be on some panel at South by Southwest and losing my shit. And then the guy I was playing with, my drummer, was obsessed with like publishing and legality. Mm. And like, he was like, hey man, I need to make sure I have some publishing on these songs. And I'm like, who, like, you were putting the cart before the horse here, man. No one gives a shit about it. So yeah, that was my whole music experience. But now I still play and I love playing, but
you got plugged into a pretty cool scene, I guess, in New York. If you were hanging with Vampire and Interpol pretty quick out of St. Louis.
Yeah. I mean, I was just gigging around, and I worked at the Apple store and, you know, I had a MySpace page and then you'd have musicians come in. And I remember Fran Healy of Travis came in and I was like, holy shit. I was like, and like Travis wasn't that big of a deal in the States. And I was like, yo, I was like, I love Travis. Like that was like my jam. Mm-hmm. Like I loved that stuff. And I was like, hey, I was like, can I send you my MySpace page? And he was like, fuck. Yeah, dude, go ahead. And I sent it to him and he responded back and he was like, yo, amazing. This is really good. You should keep doing this. And that like was like my gas for a long time, you know?
Oh, nice.
I had a similar experience. One time when Taylor and I were selling knives when we were younger, I did a house call with the bassist of Linkin Park.
Okay.
And he also really liked our demo EP. So it's kind of the same thing.
There you go.
You got gassed up by I do remember that.
Do you guys feel like that stuff happens to you now, and like are you aware of it when you're in the moment, like some kid comes up to you or somebody is like, you know, can you check my TikTok or my mixtape or whatever, and you know he's spitting bars on one of your songs or definitely. What
it does happen, and it's usually like after the show by the bus, you know, it's like mm-hmm. the kid who's like down to like stick around and say what's up and yeah, for sure. And I totally remember those moments. So I feel like Ryan and I we definitely always like make an effort to check it out and be encouraging.
Yeah, I'm sure it's pretty hard now too, because now everything is like digitally accessible, into which, you know, people are like, well, I've been, you know, DMing you all the time. Like, so Guy Berryman from Coldplay, I've like, you know, become friends with him over the years, and I will get messages in my DMs because he follows me, and they're like, hey, my daughter has cancer. I'm not even kidding you. We're trying to get this message to Guy so Coldplay can like play a song. And I'm like, dude, I have no idea. And I've recognized like this is their day 24/7 of all these people trying to come and message them and talk to them and like get, you know, just get into their inbox to either show them love or show them music or something. And it's like, you know, but they got families that are trying to figure out their life. So I kind of really sympathize for that sort of, you know, constant stress.
Yeah, I feel like it actually, now that I think about it, hasn't happened like in a long time, Tay. I feel like early on people would hand like physical CDs or whatever, you know, and it felt like, but now, I guess maybe I don't check my my DMs enough, but I don't, it doesn't happen as much anymore.
No, I was going to say, we're at the perfect amount of like indeed, you know, credibility or fame right under like where it's just like, you know, not getting bothered. You only get recognized that you're. No,
you mean no one cares?
You know, nobody's in the DMs of our friends trying to get that thing. So I feel like we've really found the sweet spot.
But I will say, to like get real, but you guys are able to make a living as musicians, which I think is still, I mean, that's the highest calling of all time. You did it.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, it's the, you know, like I said, it's the perfect level. This was always our goal, and we nailed it.
You're reminding me of, what wasn't it, James Murphy, that like he quit or they broke LCD up because he's like, I like being able to ride the subway or something like that. You're kind of like,
stop wearing the same outfit every day. That may, you know, wear a different colored shirt. There you go. Problem solved. He looks like everyone else in Williamsburg. You just don't wear the white pants and the white shirt, and maybe we're gonna get some progress. I think he has. So this is one thing. When I worked at Beggars, Thurston Moore had come in and Matador was doing a Thurston Moore album, and there was a Sonic Youth album. And I remember talking to Thurston Moore, and he was like, man, like one of my biggest regrets was that we didn't break up a long time ago so we could go and get back together. Because right at that time, Pavement was doing their reunion shows and they were getting like a million a show from Golden Voice.
What?
And and he was just like, fuck. He's like, we should have broken up a long time ago. You know, it was obviously all in jest, but at the same time, like there's truth to that, where it's like they're getting whatever they're getting at night, and it's like everyone's going nuts just to hear everyone play Slanted and Enchanted.
Like, instead
again.
Of just being like, this is like the end of the album cycle, you go like, we're going on hiatus.
Yes.
So you just make it, you go like, this is an indefinite hiatus.
That's my theory with Daft Punk and every other band now, is you take a break and then you go do your own thing. You kind of sit on some publishing deals and then you come back.
James Murphy really nailed it with that. Because
exactly. How many times did they break?
Well, I think it was 2 years. I think it was like, it wasn't even like, it was like a very quick.
How many going away MSG shows does there need to be?
Yeah, I think they nailed that. It does remind me the other side of that coin that's happening now that feels, maybe it did happen previously, but it's just the kind of throwback callback tour. And I'm doing I'm curious about this. I got to go see, so like Weezer's doing a Blue album.
Yes. Yeah.
And I got to see them. They did a last second pop-up show in Los Angeles in Highland Park for 300 people. And I got to go see the Blue album front to back in front of 300 people, which was like so incredible. Like, and what a album, so many like insane songs back to back. And then I was like, you know, this would be really cool. And I felt horrible, actually, because Ryan was so obsessed with Weezer in high school, like way more than I was.
Hell yeah.
He's flashing the W. And I truly felt so bad that it was me going and not Ryan. So I was like, I want to check out tickets. I want to go. They're playing at the new stadium in LA, the Clippers Arena. And you could not get two tickets at this like stadium. It was like sold out except for single tickets. And I don't know what Weezer's like normal tour is, but I don't think it's like a 8 months in advance sold out stadium, probably, you know?
Wow.
So I feel like it's like a newer thing where people are like, cool, like do this throwback thing and you don't even.
But people have always done like 20th anniversary, like 30th anniversary, right? Like that's
that
like.
That were huge though, that were like multiples, like way bigger than their normal.
Yeah, Weezer never stopped. I think you're right. That's a really good point because they've always been doing albums. And it's not like they got Matt Sharp back from the Rentals or something. Like it's not the original lineup, and which isn't, no one really cares that much anyway. It's not like if you listen to an ISO track of Matt Sharp, you're like, there it is. You know, but like, I think they, no, I mean, love the Rentals, but they, he did what Rivers of Weezer was basically doing these like private shows for like crypto dudes. And
sounds very
I'm not kidding. Yeah, like
Weezer's brand as today.
They would go and they would do like weekend parties for like super, super rich dudes. And I think someone, I don't know for sure, but someone got this fact that's like, let's just do a Blue album tour. Because all those people, like, I mean, in my head, like what's the number? Like when you logged on, you knew there was a number in your head that you were ready to pay for those tickets. Was it like $300-$400 a ticket? And you're like, yeah, let's do it. Blue album. I mean, that's good.
$500.
Jeez.
I could not believe it. It's just floored.
I mean, I paid almost $1,000 to see Kiss.
No way.
Yeah. And it was.
Was that at recently at MSG, their last show ever?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, if it's their last show ever.
Well, who knows, right?
Yeah. Well, exactly. They're like, we're not idiots. Like, you get it. Then you get a bite on both ends. Again, James Murphy, crush it. They'll be back in 2 years. But I was like in New York. I was going to SNL, and the hotel we were staying at was full of like children, Germans, like all these people dressed up as Kiss. And I was just what's happening? and then I figured it out. But okay. So maybe you were there. You were among them.
But even then,
I thought you were going to talk about this like new onslaught of like kind of like retro or nostalgia festivals where it's like the emo festival.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Or it's like there was one down
Saves
the road
Day in Midtown and all these, Death Cab.
It's just like a package of like 10, emo bands or emo night. Or
is the nostalgia play just seems to be, like you're able to make it function in a way probably now.
I mean, you guys could do a Gorilla Manor tour like now and sell that out. Yes, easily.
It seems like it's like another 5 years away because it's just wrapping up with like the beginning of the 2000s, right? Like,
it was when did Gorilla Manor came out? 07 or 08?
2009,
2010.
Okay. Yeah, you could do it.
Yeah, I think I think we're 3 years away from the cycle of that.
Yeah,
but would we package it with other 2009 debut album? Like, would we? You know what I mean?
Oh
like,
yeah, good question. But I think there's also right now to like zoom out. There is post pandemic. There's just a desire to see live music again, and people now have more of an understanding what a live show really entails. I mean, there's no like better feeling than just seeing your favorite band play in front of you. Like I remember someone was talking about like why theater is so good. And I realize this applies to live music too, is they're like, you're breathing the same air as the artist that you come to see perform. Like it's a very, you know, intimate experience of, you know, and then seeing them, and it's going to be played different. And especially like you guys, I mean, I don't know if you got tracks or any of that stuff behind you or any of that stuff, but like, it's not, you know, I remember seeing Fleet Foxes recently. They came, they did a show. It was incredible. It was beautiful. It was amazing. It wasn't like a crazy packed venue. I think it was like maybe 3,500, 4,000 or something like that, which is still a good size, but not too big that, like, you know, I feel like when I can see what their shoes are, when it's like, okay, you know, there's Robin wearing his Birkenstocks. Like, right. I got a good view. This is going to be a good show. It was incredible.
Do you feel like there is like a sea change happening in the sense of like, I remember, I don't know, we started to kind of like make jokes with each other, like just like no one really cares. Like it just feels like you saw every band playing the tracks, you know, everyone had like SPD pads. Like it was just like, like, did people actually care about playing live? Like what was the year that Arcade Fire headlined Coachella? And I feel like Wynn made some comment about like, this is for all the bands that are playing like real instruments or something like that. And I felt like that was the like peak of like the, like, I don't know, people getting frustrated with like DJs and stuff or whatever.
I feel like that's like the rise of like Instagram culture and smartphone culture, right?
It was.
It's just like the first time where the entire culture is disconnected from the present moment, which is, I love like you starting the interview with this. Like I actually listened to the album in full with present, which honestly is incredible. And I'm curious how many interviews we do where the interviewer has actually listened to the entire record being present. And so I think like, I'm curious if there's like a whole arc of that. And now it's like, everybody's so used to not being present and connected to it that it is like, holy shit, a live show is amazing. Because it's like, it's so removed from what your normal experience is, you know?
But maybe I'm just trying to bring it back to Steely Dan, but like, seeing like,
you always like artists.
You got to start firing people immediately to make yourself Steely Dan. That take wasn't good enough. We're only doing 30 takes. You didn't do it in the 30th take. Get the fuck out of here.
Wait, hold on a second. Okay, before you send that DM or text that friend, I know what you're thinking. You're ready to buy your first serious watch. Or in other cases, maybe your fourth or your fifth. But look, man, it's hard out there. It really is. From this dealer or that store that wants the purchase history or whatever. I mean, you're just, I don't know, you're almost ready to walk away from the whole game. But fear not, my friends. Check out Bezel. Bezel is the trusted marketplace for buying and selling your next luxury watch, with expert in-house authentication on every purchase. With over 18,000 watches listed right now, as of the time I'm recording this, from a mix of professional dealers to private sellers, you're just going to find what you're looking for. But wait, I know. You're like, Jeremy, I'm sorry. They don't have that X Rolex or that insane Omega. Well, reach out to them. Bezel has a real team of real people. Just create an account and be connected with a private client advisor, and they will guide you through the entire process every step. Once you decide on your watch, it's overnighted to Bezel HQ, where their in-house team of experts authenticate it, and then it's on your way to you. If anything is amiss, the watch is not listed correctly, whatever it is, they'll let you know, the buyer know, and the offer to refund you or source you a new one at a similar price. That's pretty good, right? This has been part of the Bezel ethos since launch. I've even spoke to the founders about it. And now you can make an offer on a watch, buy it outright, or bid it at auction. Bezel is the highest rated watch marketplace out there. Even Trustpilot shows Bezel is 4.9 out of 5 stars with rave reviews. Okay, you're still on the fence? Dig into the Blammo feed yourself and listen to my chat with the Bezel co-founders and, well, see for yourself. But you got this. I believe in you. Visit getbezel.com and buy and sell your next luxury watch. That's getbezel.com. Getbezel.com.
But like seeing like insane musicianship and seeing people that are like improvising, like is that coming back in any way where it's like, you know, instead of just seeing the band or the artist just play it as
right.
It's like is seeing a band live, you really want to see it live, you know, like I is think that going to be a change?
That's thanks to like Dead & Co and yeah. like jam music getting more mainstream. Because I remember I was talking to a friend and he was like, dude, I went and saw a couple of the Dead & Co tours. And like, did you know that they played like the songs like differently? And I was like, yeah. oh, boy.
Like every night. Yeah.
yeah. That's the fucking point. Like that's live music. I mean, because I think you have, is it Goose and a couple other of those bands that are, you know, they're all just like musical genius sort of things, jam band.
Right.
Things.
They all went to Berkeley or something.
Yeah. Or, you know, North Texas or whatever. I mean, you just kind of, you get in there. I don't know. I think there's a combination of all of that. And I think the fact that music doesn't really have a genre anymore. And that's a streaming thing. I'm sure you guys see that now where there's like, you know, like for example, you have people that are going to listen to your newest album. And then you're going to have people that are going to go and jump into Gorilla Manor or go listen to Breakers, like all within 20 minutes. There's not, you know, you don't. And like for me, sometimes I get upset about that, which is just the elitist like prick in me where I'm like, no. Those are different headspaces. Like those were different times in those people's lives. Like, you know, at least have a gut check. But like, you know, just jumping throughout a catalog, you know, of like art, like you know, it's like going to some art exhibit and you're just viewing all these things in like 30 different years, 25, 10 years apart. And be like, yeah, this all fits. You're like,
time's
well, no.
a flat circle. It's just...
But I think like the streaming stuff has done that a lot with people in the which you have older music and newer music all competing at the same level. And you're not listening and discovering things on the radio. So people are hearing like Beyonce's country album, you know, I'm like air quoting. And then, I don't know. And then like Fleet Foxes, Local Natives and, you know, Dead & Co or something, you know, all on a mixtape and all together. I mean, that just.
Or even, you know, not to sound like an A&R, but it's like we keep hearing about like these songs that are like 10 years old and they're like any song can blow up now on TikTok. You know, it's like it can be like a 15-year-old song, you know, and you're like, wait, like it's just wild. Like, I don't know. Just with what you're saying, it just feels like there's no time correlation to like anything.
Well, I think this is a little like industry insidery as well, but there's been like a big pressure for like years now that's like you shouldn't really do an album. Like making an album doesn't really make sense. Like,
no one cares about albums. Yeah.
Well, it's just like the business model of what you're talking about doesn't really support it. And, you know, we've seen that. We've been putting out records, you know, on a cadence over the last, you know, whatever, 12 years now. And you can see that. But if you're a band and you're making art in that type of way, you can't get away from it. It's like, that's what it is like to make music in a particular headspace from a particular point of view and inspiration and like give yourself to it. You have to make a body of work, you know, or like we do, and we've had to. So I think it's like why, you know, at least for a lot of bands, like the album kind of persists. And Jeremy, I just love that you're here for it, that you're listening to records that like totally fucking amazing. So thank you for caring about that. But yeah, that's it's an interesting like aspect.
Well, Jeremy's the same age as us though, you know.
Yeah, I'm 38.
Like, what are your kids doing? Yeah,
I mean, I think that's a thing though, but I also feel like more connected to stuff like this. Cause like when, you know, I was reading, it's like, oh, like you got other band members that are having kids and you have other people that like the actual like humanness, for lack of a better term, of life is affecting your guys' ability to make music. I feel in some ways that I can connect more on that because it's like, sure, I'm not going to be on stage playing, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people or whatever, but I can have the same feelings of joy and watching a child of mine, you know, walk or discover or be angry at family, you know, not functioning the way it wants, or a loved one, you know, getting really into politics and losing their mind, you know, whatever, fill in the blank of what that is. And you're like, oh yeah, we're all pretty normal. And then like I don't know what Alpharetta is about, but I think I've heard that song maybe like 25, 30 times now. Like,
oh wow,
for real. I don't, if you can explain to me what it's about, that'd be great, but I almost don't want you to? Because I don't know if it's about grief or what.
What are you?
Do you want me to? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I do. I do.
Wait, before you do, will you just give like 15 seconds on what, like, what?
Don't put him on the spot.
No, it's fine. I think, like, for me, sonically, it's my opinion. No shots to the album. It's better than any other song on the album. Especially on like the buildup of it. I mean, it's not even like a crazy dynamic song, but like there's stuff there. But, you know, I'll go and I'll listen to music with my dad. My dad's in the process of dying right now.
Oh, man.
And he was into it. He was into it more than the other stuff. And I don't know. And like the lyrics, like I'm more of a music guy. And then I will go read the lyrics later. So no shots. But like, I don't know. There was stuff about like coming back or something that what you had said on it. Because I don't have the lyrics. I have an early release, right? And there's no lyrics attached to it. I have the Loma Vista, you know, watermark, whatever, right? So I don't have anything else. And so I don't even know if I'm making up words in my head, but what is it about? If you're like, yeah, it's about a snow cone on the beach.
No. I mean, first off, that's so awesome. Love that you had that connection to it. I think like that one does feel different in a way because that was one that I brought to the table, and I'm also a music guy. Like, I feel like I start with music and then the lyrics come later, but that one, I really focused on the lyrics and tried to like embody kind of what was going on. And for me, at least, it felt like that whole song is just like about kind of being on the threshold of something big in your life where you feel like you're kind of in this in-between space, like between like two lives. So there's like your life before and you know something's about to change, but you're in this weird like liminal space. And it was like during when my wife was pregnant with our first kid, it was like, you know, this like almost like waiting room where you're just like, we know everything's about to change.
Yeah.
She's a writer as well. So we both have these creative careers, you know, we have these ambitions, but she's, you know, putting them on hold because she's dealing with like nausea and just like not able to write. And so we just, it just felt like you're kind of in this strange, like, it was like the two of us against the world almost. Like we were just like in this house preparing for our lives to change. And it just all felt like sometimes you're like almost like out of time and place. You're just kind of like, I don't know, in your own world with your partner. On the brink of something big. And so to me, like, I don't know, I picture these two people like, you know, driving in this like kind of like foggy void on this like, you know, this highway somewhere. I've never been to Alpharetta. I just really loved the sound.
Oh, it's a place. Oh my God.
It's a real place. It's one of those things where a word pops into your head. And even though you have no real connection to
Georgia.
It, just like, I was like, I have to use it because it just popped out when I was like mindlessly playing the song. But anyways, that was like the place in my head that all this was happening. I don't know. I just realized I've never actually outwardly said what the song's about. So I just realized I rambled for probably way too long.
You're fine. No, it's great.
That's what it was.
Yeah. And I think I'll just add on the music side. I'm so glad that you love that song so much because it was one that did not come like obviously or easily. And I think this version is the third recorded version. And we had like complete alternate vibes that we like completely dumped in the trash. And we do not do that. That's not normal for local natives. Like usually we figure it out and salvage like what's going on, or we just ditch the song. But we were like, this song needs to feel really classic and like it needs to like feel like it has this core about it. We knew it was special in that way and we weren't capturing that in the previous versions. So there's like no drums on this song, also relatively rare for us. And the vocals all recorded live, which we don't always do. We do sometimes do that, but we were like, we have to like record this live and capture the feeling of this song. And then we kind of built, you know, some production around it.
Like kind of like Glenn John's, Ethan John's thing, like the vocals on the performance is the vocals on the recording.
Yeah, just three microphones, us in one room kind of doing it. And the other thing that we wanted on the song is couple months ago, I'd seen these two pedal steel guitarists.
Yeah.
They both play with, like, you know, like that dude, Dijon. He like plays in his band, and they just play with like all these rad artists. And so I just hit one of those guys up and was like, we've never had pedal steel on a song, but we'd love to try. So I went to his place in Pasadena. And so there's like a lot of great, like, kind of pedal steel, lap steel on that song too, that I think is really cool.
Well, what are you running that through? Because it wasn't just clean pedal steel though. No, you had something else on it.
There's, you know, I think it's like he had run it through some like really cool like reverbs that he had.
Yeah, okay.
And then I think we had messed with it. If anything, I felt bad because I think pedal steel is inherently like country. And I kept telling him, like, is there a way to make it like less country?
Like, and he's like, what do you mean?
What do you mean? So I was like, dude, that's,
we're just
like,
gonna push this that, back like, in the mix. We're gonna add some chorus on here, a lot of reverb.
You put compression, chorus, and reverb on it.
So it was, you know, I think we kind of like, yeah, tried to like meld it into like what we had already had. But I feel like it's like just a, I just love the sound of it. And it kind of like, I guess, fit with like kind of the Southern title. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys feel that you would still, you know, because basically to kind of jump back, there was a quote where you had talked about like you were really unsure of like the progress of the band when you were playing at the Greek Theater, right? Like, and you didn't really know what was going to happen. But do you guys feel now that you are living more to make your music or just trying to make your music for a living?
I think we've always lived to make music, right? And then during this whole time period, like, I think four of the five of us have become parents. And so even like what Ryan's talking about with Alpharetta, and I have a 4-year-old. I was the first one to have a kid, right? You know, Ryan's like the newest.
So now are you kind of basking in like, yeah, you guys get it now. That's why I couldn't jump on the phone at 2 a.m.
Totally. Yeah. We only did like a couple radio shows and like some tours before lockdown. So it was relatively like, we didn't tour a lot until there were more kids in the mix, but yeah, I definitely am happy not to be the only one out here explaining what life is like in this dimension on this side of the world. It's great to share that. But I think like, so it's running up against like these things that we're talking about. But yeah, I just think we're in so deep, like back to the album comment. I think like the value that we feel in making music and from that place of what that is and being in a band, and it's like it is very pure, that's just like always kind of guided us and I think continues to and has had to. So yeah, I don't know, I think like you said, we're just so, I'm so grateful that this is our job and that like feels amazing. But at least for me, and I've been in it a little bit longer, I'm curious, Ryan, you're like just getting into this now, I think, but yeah, it feels like it switches into a different mode. There's now like being at home and parent life, and then there's like being at the studio and being on tour and that life, and it is really different. Like it couldn't be more opposite.
Well, I think the big difference I've noticed, and you know, I don't know how much you know our history, but as a band, we used to live together.
Like, yeah.
Silver Lake, and so this is basically now the opposite of living together and living and breathing 24/7, just like band life. Like now, you know, we used to tour like 10, 11 months of the year. And it was like, you just said yes to every opportunity and we're just like all in. And now you have to be so much more conscientious, I guess, of like what we're, you know, spending our time on. And so there's that where you're no longer kind of like living and breathing every second for like, you know, this like ambition we have as a band. But I think in that way, I've almost had like more gratitude for when we are doing band stuff. I'm like, you know, this is like, I'm just really happy to be making music with these guys. And like this time, yeah, I don't want to go on a 6-month tour anymore, but I'm like, you know, when we are playing shows or like in the studio, I'm like, this is really cool. So, you know, hopefully that means we're like able to like just appreciate it more. So I think it would be cool if the infrastructure with touring and everything was the same as it was 10 years ago. Now it feels like even harder to like make money on tour and support, you know,
but
our,
it is,
our families and stuff. But
I would say it's definitely better to connect with your families. I mean, in the sense that you guys can, you know, FaceTime or whatever, video chat with family members pretty easily. You know, I mean, when I was, my dad was on tour a ton when I was younger, and he would go to like rest stops and he would record a, you remember like a mini tape player, like a mini tape,
wow,
you know, He would record like a mini tape, like voice note, and then send it at the gas station or send it wherever they were. And then I would get that. And that would be how I would get to correspond with my dad. So like, you're already an order of magnitude and a better way to just, you know, converse back home while you're on the road. So
There's something so beautiful about that though. Sometimes I find like FaceTime is so like inherently just like inhuman or something that like, you're like, something about sending like a letter or like a recording of your voice in a cassette seems so awesome. But I don't know, as a kid, did you like it?
It was cool because it was like, you know, it would usually be that. And have you guys ever had corn nuts?
Yeah.
Like the worst,
yeah.
You know, but that was like the snack that I would get when I would go with my dad.
Such a truck stop. Yeah.
And so it'd be like corn nuts and one of those like little tapes. And, we would, I think it was kind of a bit of a death rattle because my mom like saw my brother and I listening to them and then rewinding them and then answering them again and then rewinding them and answering them again and again with the same answers. My mom, like basically like one of the nights my dad called, she's like, you got to stop. She's like, they're just basically like, they miss you so much that they're listening to your voice, you know, over and over again, answering the same questions with the same answer. You'd be like, hey, Jeremy, how are you? What's been going on? I'd be like, good. You know, be like, you can listen to your mom? Yeah. You know, and it's and my mom would hear it in the other room and be like, oh, this is awful. But I loved it. It was cool. Yeah. And like, you know, especially now, like I feel, you know, I'm so grateful that even with every single thing that's happening, you're just, I don't know. I try to like process grief and stuff by just looking at, this is so tacky, but like, you know, that was a chapter of your life, right? That was a part of it. And like, and that part is over. And you can kind of go and revisit it, but like you're always sort of moving forward, but still able to process, you know, what's happened to you. And you can be grateful for that, you know, versus try to just spend every moment fixing something that you felt that you didn't do a good enough job in, you know, like, oh, if only I would have said this or done that. It's like, nope, it's over. And that there's that memory and you can look at it, but like you got to go forward and it's helped a lot. So, yeah.
Yeah, I totally relate to that feeling. I mean, in a weird way, it does feel like just being in this band feels like an exercise in that. We're still doing the same thing we did when I met Taylor when we were in junior high. You know, we're making music together. And each step of the way, each album, we're like, you know, you're thinking back on like how it was or like things that worked, things that didn't work. And like, we all have our baggage, our arguments that we've had with each other. And going forward, you're just like, okay, well, you can't hold on too much to what was. We need to do like live in this chapter. I don't know. Just as you were saying that, I was like, man, I feel that so deeply. Like,
well, and you're better musicians because, you know, like, I don't know. Do you think you'd have the I Will Wait For You If It Wasn't For Hummingbird? Right. Or, I mean, cause like I love Hummingbird is probably still, that's like something that's never left any playlist I've ever had, like ever. It's just always on there. But you know, would you haven't been trying to just make that album again, right? Like these other things are different versus definitely I think some bands you get hung up on that one record or whatever that is. And then you're just trying to make that over and over again. And in a way you don't let yourself progress.
Well, to be fully candid, I mean, maybe Tay, you don't want me to say this, but like that to me, that Hummingbird's a tough one. That almost feels like our Pinkerton, where it was like, I don't know, like that was such an intense period. And I felt like the reception, at least in my mind, was not what I had hoped for. And so I
spent, oh my God,
to like
brilliant.
The next record being like, I don't want to do that again. I got to get away from that. And I know for other guys in the band, it's more like what you're saying. It's like, you know, that was like a great creative period. And so it is an interesting thing. Even within the band, we all have different perceptions of like,
oh, that's great.
Ryan has so much baggage with that record particularly.
Really? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I mean,
it's so good. No. It's so good.
That's amazing to hear.
Yeah, I loved making that record and I love that record and I think it's very beautiful. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think like to that specific point is for us, our instinct has always been to just like, there is a conscious level that's reactionary against like what Ryan just said. I think that there's a conscious element of that. And then I think there's been a thing that's like what with us, what feels right is to really truly follow where you are in that moment and follow that. And if you're doing that, if you like hold that as the sort of North Star of your creative endeavor, then I think by default, you kind of can't repeat yourself because that Hummingbird time period was so specific, and it was like completely out of grief and very intense. And, you know, we can go back there. Yeah, that period of our lives is over. And so now we're in this period, and this is what it feels like. And so we're going to follow that.
That's great. I mean, that's really beautiful. Have you had to get go and like remix any of your stuff in like Dolby Atmos or anything yet, and being forced to like re-listen to stuff? I feel like that's like the pull now.
We did do a 10-year Hummingbird, just two shows in LA at the Ford Theater, which I'd never even been to. It's right next to the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
And it's outdoor, kind of like really beautiful, like castle looking space against a hill.
It's very Shakespearean.
Like, it's very Shakespearean. It does look like you're going to do some theater for sure.
Yeah.
And they do theater there, I think. But, you know, there weren't big shows. They're like 1,200 people. And we did the album front to back.
Okay.
And then we had an intermission, did other stuff. And yeah, just similarly, like it was like reliving that album for me was like so amazing, and I loved it. And there's clearly a connection to like certain of our fans that like have connected so deeply with that record, and they'll often have stories about grief in their lives that it like it was time and place and they like related to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that goes very deep for our fans. And it was such a beautiful experience and beautiful night. And yeah, I think Ryan was like, just hates looking back and was really struggling. I mean, it's really difficult for him to do. But it was amazing for me.
Yeah. That's great that at least you to be conscious of like how you feel in a moment means that you can more or less kind of control your response to it. And I'm not, this isn't some weird new age stuff or anything, but like I've been, you know, as I've been trying to deal with all these different things from like career ups and downs and kids and family and all this stuff, like I'm now just being like, okay, like this happened and I'm not going to like go and then just like whine or sit and like wallow in my grief or my suffering, but like I'm going to be aware that this happened. And the fact that I'm aware, I can now control my response. Like, so just because I have a bad day doesn't give me a license to be a dick. Like, I mean, just to be very blunt, you know, and so that'll be stuff like my wife and I will talk about all the time where it's like, hey, I'm having a real bad day today. Like, if you can just give me some grace or like go easy on me, but I'm not going to just use this as an excuse to not do stuff. And I think like that's been like the greatest part of like growing up and being an adult for me is now learning how to like sit with some of that and know that like, oh, it's not going to last forever.
Well, it's almost like, yeah, it sounds like it's kind of like a mindfulness kind of thing, or like, like you said, an awareness, like just knowing like that I'm going to be like, these feelings are just really heavy. Like just knowing that, like how I'm going to react to it is such a huge part of it, and allowed me probably to enjoy it more than I would have when I was younger, when I would have probably just been like angry, but not know why or something. Like,
what do I do with these feelings, man?
Exactly. Like
Linkin Park, like, where are you?
Where are you, Linkin Park? But it was cool, man, seeing everyone in the crowd and seeing these guys and, you know, read. Yeah. Just, I don't know. Almost like seeing it with a new lens. I was able to be like, oh, I see why we did what we did at the time, like what we were dealing with. Like,
did you all record it?
Whenever
it's like a you know, LA Philharmonic venue, they charge you like $18,000 to record it, the show.
Yeah. Oh, it's a shame.
But time to go Dead and Co and just let people bootleg.
Yeah, I know.
You need Dick's Picks or be on Nugs, whatever it is.
Yeah,
that's all right though. Maybe you can do it again. Maybe you won't want to, but you know,
yeah.
I'm sure you'll get to play those songs again. I mean, you know, you were talking about Weezer doing that stuff. I mean, how many times were people been begging for them to do a Blue Album tour or whatever, and now they're finally doing it?
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you actually buy tickets? You never answered if you bought tickets, or did you just look at it and you walk away?
No, I was trying to buy like at least four so I could go with my wife and then like probably Ryan, because they're the, like, I then told, like, I knew Ryan was going to be like losing his mind.
Yeah.
I'll be able to see that. And then I went home and I told my wife, and I didn't realize that. So I put on the record and she sang every word from every verse just like immediately. I was like, whoa, she just had it. So I was like, I wanted to get four tickets. So we're going to have to, you know, knock on all our industry doors and see if we can get.
I'm sure. Go do it in a different town. That's what you should do.
I know. Yeah. So then you're like, okay, cool. It's just like, you know, $2,000 for four tickets and then air flights. And then you're like, and I've never like understood traveling for a show, but I just went through the experience because we literally had that combo. It's like, okay, we should just like book some flights, some hotels, and some. I was like, wow, we really arrived at the will travel for concert stage of our lives.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's like the best feeling ever when you start to like, when you go to Vegas for a concert, like the amount of friends that I have that all went to go see, you know, U2 at the Sphere. Because even then I was like, man, that's so lame. I was like, U2 so washed. No way. And my friend went and did it. And he was like, man, he's like, when they started playing, you know, stuff from Joshua Tree and everything, he's like, I was crying. I didn't know what was going on. He's like, I was just looking around. I just couldn't stop crying. He's like, and everyone else in the room was crying too. He's like, and we were all together. It's like 20,000 of us just crying.
Wow.
I was like, that's pretty cool.
Your dad definitely would approve of that.
Right? And so, I mean, I don't know.
That's not church. What's church, you know?
Bingo. Like, there you go.
That's incredible. Yeah.
So go get some Blue Album tickets. I mean, I don't know if there's going to be Weezer at the Sphere. It's going to be a short show. The album's like 35 minutes, right? It's a short album.
Yeah, it was quick. I'm sure they'll do a set too at the arenas and stadiums. But for us, they just played it front to back, and then that was it. And I was so happy with that. That was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wish I would have gotten to see the Cars or something at some point in my life. I mean, there's a lot of like bands, I feel like, because now that's the thing. It's like, man, that might be their last show ever. You got to figure it out, or however old that person is. I mean, I feel like, I don't know. There's the Strokes, they're going to keep doing a bunch of tours. They'll be fine. But like, there's a lot of, I don't know, bands that I feel like maybe you just won't see them again. I don't know.
Well, I think for me, it would be like Blur. Like, I got to catch them.
Yeah.
And then, if Oasis ever gets back together, that'd be sick.
So, okay.
Yeah, I would travel for that.
Yeah, for sure. You're the only one who's like, I think they're going to do it. And I'm like, I'm feeling good about it. And I think
it's when the money's right, they're
going to
do it.
Yeah, I love you saying when the money's right.
No, I mean, but so that's the thing, right? Like, it's funny you mentioned Oasis. So yesterday I went for a run, and a lot of times I'm like, I'm going to go find like just an old album, and I'll just like, and so I put on What's the Story, Morning Glory, and I was running, and I'm like, holy shit, like this album is so incredible. And next thing you know, late at night last night, I'm in this rabbit hole looking up all these different like stories about like why the Gallagher brothers broke up and what was going on here and here. And basically, like, I didn't realize this. Oasis was so big that they played in the course of a week, they played four different shows, and each show was over 180,000 people at the show. And also at one point, one in every three houses in the UK had an Oasis album.
Unbelievable.
That's insane, man. But those guys hate each other with a passion.
Oh, yeah. That's what I loved. Did you watch that documentary, the Nebworth one, where they played and it was like 2 days and 300,000 people or something?
No, I'll have to add it. Yeah.
Because it was just so quintessential. Like the way in which they just, the singer, at least Liam, could not like give a shit, like did not meet the moment of like he just was wasted singing in front of like 150,000 people. Like it was like any other show. Like, I don't know. It was just perfect. It was so good. But yeah, I hope they get back together.
We'll see. We'll see. Well, before we wrap, is there any other stuff you guys want to like add or mention or chat through?
I think like one thing to mention about the two albums.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, it's Amnesiac. So you did cover it. But it's exciting for us because we've never done like such a larger, you know, kind of like, you know, thematically tied like two album composition. And just like one thing I'll mention about it, I don't know if you caught this, but the name of like the two albums together,
oh, it's a sentence,
is the sentence, is the line, time will wait for no one, but I'll wait for you. And that's the first lyric on like the first record, and it's also the last lyric on the last record. And yeah, we just had never like made this kind of like larger body of work that encompassed like so much and so much of that
with
time.
That much forethought. Usually it's like last minute, like, oh, what if we do this? It was like, let's plan this out. And that felt good to have a like, a longer goal with these albums.
We're very democratic and we do our lyrics democratically. And like, yeah, so it's just like really amazing for us. We pulled off a concept.
Wait, it's not over though, right? You guys aren't just like going to stop. I mean, what you said, it sounded like you're about to say, with that being said, peace.
No, that's it. With that being said, peace. We definitely couldn't buy a third record or anything to it. No, that's
no. I think the next record will be just a new, like you said, just a new chapter, new,
right?
Different thing. Yeah.
This, I mean this because I love the logo. But you're not getting rid of the logo, are you? It's the art design for the But I'll Wait for You with the LN. It's funny because I didn't realize it was on the previous album, the Time I'll Wait for You album. It's like hidden because you're standing in front of it.
On the photo shoot for it. So like we had those things constructed.
Yeah.
Originally,
it's very Spinal Tap in a way, because they were not supposed to be giant wood panels. They were supposed to be like lightweight in some material. But they showed up like weighing like 300 pounds each.
Well, it was Ryan's idea. He was like, it'd be so cool if they're three-dimensional. And they were like, totally 3D, like almost made out of balloons or something like that, or like some material. And it was like, cool. And then we made they're like made of wood. And
wow,
so hard to move. We have to like rent this truck every single time we want to move them around.
It's like hundreds of dollars just wasted. Yeah.
And it barely fits in the truck just to like move them. And so we've been like moving them around. And so for the final, the album shoot for But I'll Wait for You, we took them around to these different locations. We had the truck. And the last one, we went to this like garbage dump. And there's this crane like chomping at it. And we threw it into the dump.
No! So it's gone?
They're gone.
You should have just like auctioned them off or something.
That's a good point.
Yeah, we just like had to be rid of them. We couldn't.
I get it. I respect that.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah.
It is funny, the Spinal Tap reference. I rewatched that the other day when it's like Stonehenge is in danger of being crushed by dwarves.
It just keeps happening to us. So we keep like we're gonna have these panels, and then they show up, and they're just like not what we thought. And we're like, why?
Our production element, yeah. We often have a Spinal Tap moment when we create the production, like for our live show, for some reason.
They're filming it now, right now. I don't know, the new Spinal Tap, whatever. And it's like,
what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they announced that they were going to do it for a long time, and then the writer's strike, and that slowed everything down. And then, but it's like those dudes are so rich, they don't need any money. Like Harry Shearer is a Simpson. Like he.
So they're all going to be involved in it.
That, yeah, all three: Michael McKean, Harry Shearer, and Christopher Guest. And cool. Yeah, they're doing it. And there's I think they got what's his face, Chad Sexton or whatever from Chili Peppers. There's like all these musicians that they're like throwing in it. Yeah. But I feel like they're musicians who, I don't know if those guys seriously care, but maybe they do. But
yeah,
I don't know. That's just me being a cynic. I'm excited for it. I mean, I've rewatched that movie a couple times a year. So.
Yeah, it feels like one of those tour bus watches, like, you know, that and the Metallica documentary where it like hits close to home that you're like, oh, God.
Are you, I'll end with this question. Are you guys considering, in terms of like tour stuff, what are your thoughts on people that basically just do residencies? So you don't really like tour anymore. You go to a few different cities and you just chill there and then you come home.
I mean, if you can do it, it sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, I do feel like those types of things are the thing where you're like, like I have a family now, and like it is, it's more of like, do I live to do it, or do I do it to live a little bit? So that said, I was going to say I'm open to that. I'm open. Mm-hmm. If any crypto bros out there want to hire us private, I'm change my mind on that as well.
Yeah, go do that. Take the money.
I'm willing.
Take the money.
Yeah, I'm willing to think about that. But yeah, the residency thing, I think could be really cool. But also we always feel like a personal responsibility whenever you post a tour. There's like all these comments.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you ever come to Florida? You know, they're like so upset.
Do you know how hard it is to get to Florida? Do you know how much money we lose on a tour trying to get to Florida?
Yeah.
Go ask Chris Carrabba.
Listen, my agent, we've talked to them, but the bus, the cost of gasoline and getting to the bottom of Florida is too hard. So I don't know. I think like we really do try and get around and play places.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Why don't we just skip the residency and we'll just do a cruise ship, Tay? Let's just do our own cruise.
Oh, there you go. Bring the travel to us.
I think that's a great idea. That also just sound. I'm ever since COVID and everything else, there's no way in hell I'm riding a cruise ever again. Don't
that's
care.
True.
No way. You're just stuck.
And then,
Right before COVID, we did Parahoy, which is Paramore's Cruise Festival.
Oh, that actually sounds kind of cool.
And it was amazing. It was.
We had a blast.
Yeah, like, we had the best time. Yeah.
But I wonder if for them it was not so fun being like trapped on a
yeah, you're,
ship.
That's it.
I don't know.
You know, I mean, yeah, you're like, stuck
this
there.
Is great.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, but, gents, thank you so, so much. Thank you again. Congrats on the album. And hopefully I'll be seeing you out on the road soon. But thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. We'll see ya.
You've been listening to Blammo. Our show is produced by Blammo Media. We're edited by Amar Lowell. And our theme music, as always, by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. If you like what you heard, you know the drill. Share the pod with a friend. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars or thumbs up on whatever other thing you're listening to us on, whether it's Dingledorp or Bing Bong, whatever it's called. But you can also follow us on Instagram for all the hot content. If you want to talk to us and give us your hot take, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at info@blammopod.com. Last but not least, super ultra important. If I had an air horn, I would press it right now. You got to come and join us over on Patreon. Because the fun never stops over there. Look, the live show, the free show, whatever you want to call this, we take breaks here and there, but Patreon, it never stops. And we also got exclusive shows like Die Workwear, hosted by Derek Guy and Peter Zatolo, and the Triple J Show, hosted by yours truly with John Moy and Gene DeLeon. There's just a ton of stuff over there. So check it out at patreon.com/Blammo. If not, no worries. We got hundreds and hundreds of free episodes in the feed. And more to come. So we will see you all soon.